This is the In Self-Defense Podcast with Don West and Sean Vincent, exploring high-profile self-defense cases and identifying the lessons learned for concealed carriers. I'm Sean Vincent. I'm here with Steve Moses and Don West. And today's podcast, we are going to respond to some criticism, some vocal objections to an article that I published on CCW Safe last week, at least last week as of the recording of this podcast. And I quoted both Don and Steve in this article. And gents, you guys are on the line here, but I want to refresh our memories, and also the listeners have, so they have a fresh memory of this article. I'm going to read this article now real quick. This was called Finding a Hard Corner. It's a tactical lesson from the Charles Dorsey case. It's a case, Don, that you and I explored in detail from a legal perspective, and we spoke to Steve about it from a tactical point of view. And here it goes. Gary Espinoza, a stranger to Charles and Barbara Dorsey, broke the latch on the Dorsey's front door in a fit of rage. And when he stepped foot into the home, Mr. Dorsey fired a single fatal shot. In a security video recording of the incident, Mrs. Dorsey is heard screaming, "Why did you do that?" Mr. Dorsey replies, "He pushed the door open." In our four-part series, Defense of Last Resort, we reveal that Espinoza was an overnight guest of the Dorsey's new neighbors. Both homes looked similar and partially shared a driveway. When Espinoza first came to the Dorsey's door at 1 a.m., he had a blood alcohol level of at least 0.22. That's nearly three times the legal limit to drive. He almost certainly mistook the Dorsey's home for his friend's. Before breaking in, Espinoza had repeatedly knocked and rang the doorbell for nearly 13 minutes, only becoming visibly frustrated and enraged in the final moments. Mrs. Dorsey called 911 after the initial encounter, but it took police a long time to dispatch to their rural address. Espinoza's family cried out for justice. They described Gary as a family man who coached the kids' sports teams, and he ran a successful IT business. He wasn't a criminal, they said, and he didn't deserve to be shot and killed over a misunderstanding. To the family's dismay, the local prosecutors declared the shooting legally justified. Nonetheless, questions remain about whether the use of force, while legal, was absolutely necessary. Don West, criminal defense attorney and National Trial Counsel for CCW Safe, says there's really no question that his conduct was legal, but might there have been another approach that conceivably could have saved the life of Espinoza, who by all accounts is an innocent guy, certainly in terms of the criminal liability? Steve Moses, firearms instructor and CCW Safe contributor, suggests Dorsey had another good tactical option that would have bought him time and possibly changed the ultimate outcome. This is the quote. He would have probably been in a better situation, Steve says, had he retreated along with his wife into a room, got into a hard corner, which is a corner on the same side of the doorway to the room, and then ensconced there and waited either for the police to arrive and take care of the situation, or then deal with the person if he came into the room. Don West agrees. In any situation that's confusing or uncertain, or there is ambiguity, then creating some distance, extending the safety zone, is better because it gives you more options. It gives you distance. It gives you time. It gives you an opportunity to reevaluate the moment. To reinforce that point, Steve adds, if somebody, after you told them not to come in, had broken through the door, made entry into your house, came all the way back to that room where you were, that strips away a lot of the ambiguity, and that person is probably a dangerous threat in which, if they continued, the only thing you could do, contingent on the apparent capacity of the individual to inflict harm, is probably go ahead and use a gun. Once Espinoza was in the house, Steve suggests, he may very well have realized he was in the wrong location, and a threat perceived by the Dorseys would have evaporated. Steve admits that in hindsight, hindsight's 2020, it's difficult to criticize the split-second life and death decisions concealed carriers have to make when they choose to use their firearms in self-defense. Steve admits that hindsight is 2020, and it's difficult to criticize the split-second life and death situations concealed carriers have to face when they choose to use their firearms in self-defense. But the hard truth is that every use of force incident will not only be criticized, but also scrutinized by law enforcement. I like to think that by taking the time to dissect high-profile self-defense cases, we're creating 2020 foresight. That is, we're imagining ourselves in real-life self-defense scenarios and absorbing the lessons that could keep us out of trouble in the future. The lesson from the Dorsey case is that the front door is not the only threshold where you can defend yourself from a home intruder. And in fact, it may not even be the most tactically sound location. If you retreat to another room and ensconce in a hard corner, as Steve Moses suggests, then if the intruder comes in the room, you'll very likely see him before he sees you, and you'll be ready to use your firearm at a range where you're likely to be highly accurate. You also have given yourself time to disambiguate a potentially confusing situation, and if you must use deadly force, you can be more certain it is justified. Finally, every effort you make to avoid an armed confrontation, even in your own home, helps reduce your legal liability in the aftermath of a self-defense shooting. So the responses that we got from that include comments that go like this. One gentleman wrote, when an intruder physically breaks through any barrier to gain access to your home, he, she should be met with deadly force. Retreating is unnecessary and unwise. Another comment here says, when deadly force is justified, you stand your ground and implement said force. Another comment reads, no one is breaking in to say hi, let's hang out. And then another one yet says, I'm sick and tired of losing our rights because it doesn't look good and we have to keep retreating. What if an armed man and one's inside, he started shooting? You might not have time to try to decide, gee, is he holding a Nerf gun? Is this a prank or a joke? And you and your wife end up dead. So, gents, I want to address these comments. I think they're strong comments and heartfelt and reflect the thinking of a lot of folks. But I think we took a look back at what we said and what we wrote, and we stand behind it. And I think we're going to go deeper into these issues today. But before we do, I think it's a good time to remind our listeners and the readers of the columns that we publish on CCW Safe who we are and why we are, why our opinions on self-defense matter. And Steve, I'd like to start with you.
Okay, very well. I've been a defensive firearms trainer for over 26 years. I'm a recently retired deputy constable, and I spent over 10 years on a multi-precinct special response team. I own multiple instructor certifications, including range master, advanced handgun instructor, and defensive shotgun instructor, red zone knife defense instructor, adaptive striking foundations instructor, modern samurai project red dot sight instructor, and I am a state of Texas personal protection officer instructor. In regard to my experience as being a member on that special response team, my training included a 40-hour SWAT school that I needed to, I needed to go to in order to obtain that certification. Plus, I took additional classes on high-risk entry, hostage rescue, high-risk warrants, mechanical breaching, and high-risk entry planning. And so, based upon those courses that I completed, following training exercises, and my participation in actual multiple entries, after a while, I kind of gained an understanding of how important location was when it came to coming into contact with a potential aggressor. There were several entries in which I participated, and when our team came in contact with persons in the house just inside the threshold. And basically, during those encounters, I felt like that was a relatively level playing field. That is, we saw that person literally as quickly as they saw us. And I kind of felt like, in regards to, from the benefit of the person in that home, they were definitely at a disadvantage. And then once we made entry into that home or apartment, we would then have to clear the house. And it was during that time that my blood pressure would typically ratchet up a little bit, because we felt like anytime we went room to room, we knew that if there was a person in a hard corner, ostensibly armed with a firearm, they were going to see us before we saw them. So that was something that I was always concerned about. And from the perspective of being a farms instructor and basically someone, an analyst, someone who's been interested, in all of this for years, I felt like, okay, I've kind of, obtained some information from this particular training and participating in these particular entries into what it might be like in order to defend your home. And then the other thing I'd like to add is that during that same time, Sean, I attended Craig Douglas's Arm Movement and Structure courses. Arm Movement and Structures, it's a 20-hour class. I attended that 3 different times. And he is one of the most phenomenal defensive, firearms and tactics instructors, I think, of our present era. Matter of fact, I believe he has actually been contracted to take that, teach that course at Fort Bragg for military operators. And that particular class addressed the problems that a solo operator dealing with aggressors in, a home or a structure might face and how to deal with that. It was a force-on-force class in which we wore paintball masks and used airsoft pistols. And it was very, very structured. In many instances, there was a free-flow element to it. But in other instances, the course, required you to play a particular role, which would be, a homeowner in this position, or a homeowner who took a hard corner, or being a bad guy. And I learned pretty quick, painfully, if you will, that setting up in a hard corner and waiting for someone to make entry was far better than, standing there in the open at the threshold and going into kind of a, a version of the okay, corral gunfight, where both of you just stand there, at conversational distance and just blaze away. And so that's one of the reasons that I kind of have this opinion. And the other reason is I'm one of the very few people I know that as a relatively untrained homeowner, this was back in the 80s, I actually encountered and captured a burglar inside my apartment at the threshold. And I remember immediately after the police came and escorted him away, just the realization is like, oh my God, how easily I could have been killed. And I simply was not prepared for that. A couple of other things I might throw out right now is that based upon, what I've taught and what I teach, what I teach and what I've read, is that not every home intrusion is going to be someone that in this particular case was like, Mr. Espinoza. I believe there was another case where a young female that had been in a car accident was trying to get in a home. There are actually home invasions that occur in which multiple people come in wearing body armor, yelling police, and armed with long guns and shotguns. And so, in my opinion, any tactical advantage that I can take in order to, better the chances that I can protect myself and my family, I'm going to do that. And I just feel like falling back to a more defensible position is just a better, it's just a better tactic for homeowners.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about that in much more depth here in a couple of minutes. But Don, I'd like to turn to you, and you are clearly the most famous of the three of us, having been on television during the high-profile George Zimmerman defense. Give us a little bit of a peek into your background as a criminal defense attorney.
Sure, thanks, Sean. Next year will actually be my 40th year in practice as a licensed lawyer. I have spent that entire time as a criminal defense trial attorney. In fact, actually, I've been board certified as a criminal trial specialist by the Florida Bar for over 30 years, since 1987. And I say that only because it's been a focus, it's been an interest of mine, and to the degree that you are board certified, it's an acknowledgement by the bar that you have established a specialty, you've demonstrated special skill in this narrow practice, as well as the recommendations of judges and lawyers. You actually have to take a test, kind of like a mini bar exam for that. And to continue that certification, You're required to take a certain number of courses over the certification period. Again, the recommendations of other lawyers and such. So I point that out because for my entire practice, I have focused on criminal trial work. And frankly, for the last 8 or 9 years, almost all of my work has been in the self-defense arena. I've tried a number of self-defense cases over the years by myself as sole lead counsel. I have co-counseled cases. I have consulted on self-defense cases. And certainly because of my interest in that particular area of the law, I pay a lot of attention to what I read in the newspapers about other self-defense type cases, the kinds of scenarios where people seem to get prosecuted most often, the kinds of scenarios where for something they did sometimes, or just the circumstances or the legal issues involved that they don't get. I am in no way claiming to be a tactician in terms of self-defense safety or the physical acts of self-defense. Steve is the expert in firearm training and operation, understands the tactics of what helps you win that first fight when you are confronted by someone who poses an imminent threat of great bodily harm or death. My role and my involvement, simply by virtue of being the trial lawyer that comes in after the fact, is in after the fact, meaning I'm not telling people what to do and how to do it when they have to defend themselves physically. But I know from my experience what seems to be the kinds of cases that get the prosecutor's attention, that maybe make a difference in the eyes of law enforcement as to what cases they vigorously pursue, and others where they're more inclined to agree right from the beginning that it was an act of self-defense. It's the luxury of the armchair quarterback or the Monday morning quarterback, where I'm not directly involved in that incident. But once one has survived that threat to their life, they may very well face that second fight that we've been calling it, the next fight, which is navigating and ultimately prevailing in the criminal justice system. So that's my perspective. I defer to Steve on all things tactical. I'm happy to contribute to this conversation to the extent I can that relates to legal issues that may surround some of the stuff that we've touched on already. I might point out that one has special rights in your home that you don't necessarily have in any other place, and that includes states where there still is a legal duty to retreat, and that also includes states where there is no legal duty to retreat, those that have adopted stand your ground self-defense statutes or respect that stand your ground aspect of self-defense.
Thanks, Don. As for me, Sean Vincent, I'm a litigation consultant. I came upon it almost accidentally, but my first exposure to self-defense from the second fight perspective, Don, that you indicated, was on the Zimmerman case, where I served as at first sort of a media consultant and then sort of an all-around person who lent his thoughts on the issues that we faced. And out of that opportunity, I got to start helping to pick juries for self-defense cases. I worked with an indigent defense organization building a program to qualify juries for murder cases, which almost always included a self-defense claim. I commented and wrote in newspapers about high-profile self-defense cases, and then it became a passion of mine and at first an avocation, an intense, passionate hobby where I would research and follow high-profile self-defense cases that were in the press. And I've compiled notes on those. I've written about them extensively for CCW Safe. During that time, I've had a chance as a litigation consultant to be involved in more depth in some self-defense cases on the defense side, on the advocacy for the defender. And throughout that process, I've gotten to know a lot of people, a lot of defenders who I believed were truly in fear for their lives and made what they thought was a good decision to fire in self-defense, but faced some pretty extraordinary obstacles legally to become justified. And some of these folks were not found to be justified, and in a lot of cases it's really broken my heart. And so I found myself in a unique position because of the experience I've had and the research that I've done and all the cases that I've deeply studied. That Don and you and I have talked about this in a lot of podcasts for CCW Safe. We can see patterns, you know, very quickly. We start to see things, common mistakes that people make that can turn an otherwise justifiable use of force into murder. And often, surprisingly, that includes sometimes a use of force within somebody's home, where, as you described just a few moments ago, you have the strongest legal protections and the most deference from the law for your decision to use deadly force. So that's how I come to this. And this Dorsey case was really an interesting case, Don, because to go to your comment that we quoted in the article, nobody is questioning whether or not Dorsey was legally justified in using deadly force. The investigation was thorough. It took about 4 weeks, but there was, I don't think, ever a strong inclination that anyone would be charging Dorsey for the homicide of Gary Espinoza. And the prosecutor covered his bases, explained it to Espinoza's family before he announced it publicly, that this was justified. And as we get into this conversation, I'd like you to reinforce why this was legally justified.
First of all, it was Mr. Dorsey's home. And historically, there have always been special protections in the law for those that have had to defend their home against an intruder. Even where in other circumstances, you would have the legal duty to retreat, run away if you can safely to avoid using deadly force, pursuant to what everybody has certainly heard by now as the Castle Doctrine, you've historically had the right to defend your home against an intruder without first having to retreat. So in the sense that Mr. Dorsey was defending his home against someone that came through the door without permission, Mr. Dorsey had the right to defend himself without first having legally to retreat, to leave the home or look for some other safe haven. Secondly, under most modern self-defense statutes, the legislatures around the country have conferred special status on the use of force for someone that's defending their home that doesn't typically exist for the use of force elsewhere. And by way of example, in Andrew Branca, who is a partner with CCW Safe and a nationally renowned expert on the law of self-defense through his published materials, his blog, and the classes that he teaches, puts categories of types of situations where you have more or less protections under the law. And he has this category of highly defensible property or a highly defensible situation. And the home is perhaps the most highly defensible in that the law presumes typically that if someone breaks into your home, there's an aspect of entering by force or unlawful entry through a window, something not that it's an Amway salesman. Oh, that's just dated me, hasn't it? Knocking on the door and finds the door open by accident and comes through. We're talking about someone who's forcibly entering in some way. Typically, the homeowner is presumed to be reasonably in fear of great bodily harm or death, and therefore the actions in response to that intruder are considered reasonable and lawful, so long as there hasn't been something in this sequence to completely disrupt that or to rebut that presumption. So in virtually all respects, under the facts of the Dorsey case, Espinoza's conduct identified himself by action as an intruder, a forcible intruder, in that he was able to get the locked door open by jostling it or what have you. And once he made entry into the home, Mr. Dorsey, in my opinion, was legally allowed to use deadly force to defend himself and protect other occupants of the house, in this case, clearly his wife.
Steve, I want to read the quote from you from the article and give you a chance to respond to it. And the quote goes like this: "He would have probably been in a better situation had he retreated along with his wife into a room, got in a hard corner," which is a corner on the same side of the doorway, "and then ensconced there and waited either for the police to arrive and take care of the situation or then deal with the person if he came into the room." And I'd like to start this conversation with this word, retreated. Had he retreated along with his wife? I think that in a self-defense context, retreated maybe has a negative connotation. But I think, Steve, and correct me if I'm wrong, you meant that as a tactical retreat, as a way of moving to a stronger position to defend himself.
Absolutely so. And, you know, in retrospect, you know, after this, you know, these readers made these comments, I'm like, well, I kind of understand where they might have read something into that other than what I actually meant. That is, you know, we talked about that a little bit earlier. That is the problem, of course, once you put something in an article, there's no one at that time to question you and go, oh, do you really mean retreat or give up or, you know, capitulate? And when the answer is, no, I don't, it's a tactical withdrawal, but you are removing yourself. You're increasing the distance between you and yourself in terms of, you know, unarmed combative sports, et cetera, a retreat a few feet in order to gather and, you know, go ahead, get into a stronger position or recover and defend yourself is a perfectly acceptable term. And so to that end, Sean, I agree. I can kind of understand where someone might have gotten an impression that perhaps I was referring to that in much more of a passive sense, which I was not.
Right. We're not running away from the fight. In fact, I'd heard the word ensconced before. I never thought about it deeply, but I actually looked it up when I wrote that article to get the dictionary definition. And it's to establish or settle in a comfortable, safe, or secret place. And so ensconcing yourself is really fortifying your position and this retreat, or we'll call it a tactical withdrawal from now on, was for the purposes of fortifying yourself somewhere else.
I agree. You are actually moving to a stronger, more defensible position, in my opinion.
Don, what do you make of that word retreated?
When you hear the word retreat, I think that it has connotations. Of course, it depends how it's used, but there's a connotation that you have in some ways lost, that you are maybe a coward, that you don't have the wherewithal or the cojones to stand and fight a threat. And to me, that is, it's a distortion of both the tactical issues, as Steve talks about them, and also it would be a misapplication as to how the law requires, in some circumstances, where you have a legal duty to retreat. I don't like the word in the context of self-defense unless it's clear how it's specifically being used, especially from a tactical standpoint. I'm no expert on tactics, as I've said, but I read a little bit, and I know that some of the greatest warriors in history, those that have commanded the greatest armies in history, have employed a notion of tactical retreat, because refusing to engage at a particular moment because of how one assesses the situation is not just a choice, but the best choice to not only prevail that day, but to be able to live to fight another day. And in my limited understanding of history, one could never accuse these warriors and generals and emperors of cowardice.
Steve, I want to reinforce something that you said during your introduction, and I want to make sure that our listeners didn't miss the significance of the hands-on experience you've had from both sides of an encounter like this. So what I heard you say is that in your career being involved in law enforcement, that you have actually participated in live actual scenarios where you and a team of other tactical operators storm a house where there is believed to be an armed bad guy inside. Is that, did I get that right?
That's correct. I'll have to rethink the word storm a little bit to make sure that that also sure. doesn't have any connotation other than, but basically, I mean, this was done lawfully. It was done pursuant to a writ or a warrant. The persons or persons had been served notice that we were going to, you know, come in there and repossess that property or evict the occupants, or in some cases, you know, execute warrants. This was always a knock and announce. We knocked on the door, we announced our presence, and then if they didn't open, we would mechanically breach the door and make entry. So that is correct.
And what I heard you say is that from the position of someone breaking in a door and encountering the occupant, you would much rather encounter them there on the threshold than have to consider the fact that they're hidden somewhere in the house and have to go find them.
Absolutely. We basically, the point man and the second man in, and typically on the, on, and again, it was a limited number of entries I made. I was typically the second or the third man in. As soon as you broke that threshold, you were pretty much in a position where you could see everything largely in that room. And so from a, let me just kind of explain this a little bit. Basically, on most of these entries, the point man would go in and he would choose one direction or the other. And basically what we're doing, our concern is actually the hard corners. And so his objective would be to go to one direction, and myself being the second man in, I would key off that whatever direction he chose, and I would go the opposite direction. So our goal was to immediately get eyes on those hard corners, as well as pick up anything that we saw immediately in front of us. And that's where we felt like we had our greatest tactical advantage. For all practical purposes, we were seeing that person at approximately the same time they were seeing us. However, once we cleared that room, or in some instances you've got two person, even if you had contact, the rest of your team would then go and clear the rest of the house. And we typically do that in two or three man sub teams or sub units. And basically you'd have to go in there, and then it's just like, okay, you can kind of see a little bit on out from the outside what's in that room. You cannot see what's in those corners. And the only way to go in there and see what's in there is you physically have to make a full or partial entry. And at that particular point, you knew that the person, if they were hiding in that hard corner, they were going to see you significantly before you were going to see them. And plus, they were going to be in a more advantageous position in order to, you know, address you with a firearm.
Let me read one of the comments here, and I'd like to discuss some of the top four comments that we got, because I think they made, like I said, strong and heartfelt points, and we'll explore those. So here's one. When an intruder physically breaks through any barrier to gain access to your home, he or she should be met with deadly force. Don, I want to start with you legally. You indicated that the homeowner has special considerations under the law, and someone who breaks in or breaks through a barrier to access your home is presumed to be a threat. And you are allowed as the homeowner to presume that, which then, under most circumstances, opens this window of justification. But this should word, he or she should be met with deadly force, from a legal perspective, how do you interpret that statement?
I think the one thing that I've learned in my professional history of being involved in self-defense cases, working with other lawyers involved in self-defense cases, and reading about cases involving self-defense, is that while the law in virtually every situation involving the invasion of a home authorizes the use of deadly force, as Andrew Branca calls the home as highly defensible property. In my mind, I see no real justification for drawing such a hard line that there is only one response to that scenario. I think that if one allows themselves to take that position, while legally they may turn out to be justified, there may very well be other scenarios where it turned out to be not a prosecutable offense, but nonetheless a tragedy. What I've learned is that while the law of self-defense is pretty consistent all around the country, the factual scenarios, even those that we've been able to lump into certain categories, are often very, very specific on those few facts that turn the case from lawful self-defense into a murder. And then, of course, those that may have been preventable by taking some steps, creating more of an opportunity to assess and reassess what was going on. There's also different kinds of entry. You know, there's the forced entry, a non-consensual entry where somebody has to break in a door or come through a window. Those are all forced entries. It doesn't require physically smashing the door down. And if one physically smashes the door down, the intent to come in and the assumption that they intend harm, I think, is very powerful. But that can be offset by other facts that become known. And since this discussion started with the Dorsey case, let's remind people and encourage them to go look at the video of that incident. This is an event that took place over 11, 12, or 13 minutes, where Mr. Dorsey kept going back and forth to the door and pounding on it and asking to be let in, being told to go away. Essentially, the police were supposed to have been on their way. The homeowner thought Mr. Espinoza had left. The door was deadbolted before, but the lock, the deadbolt was released. And then when Mr. Espinoza came back the last time, obviously confused, as we look at it, he was able, by jiggling the door, to get it open. And that's when Mr. Dorsey shot him, killed him, lawfully, or at least not obviously not in self-defense. And that's what started the investigation, of course, then our discussion. I remember Andrew Branca giving an example about him being home upstairs and people broke into his house, or that was the hypothetical he was giving, to steal stuff. That's usually, the burglary is usually to steal things, although it could be a home invasion for more violent acts. But I remember Branca talking about standing at the top of his stairs, not going down to confront the people that had come in his hypothetical to steal the TV, but announcing to those downstairs within the sound of his voice, take anything you want, however, take one step up these stairs and you'll regret it for the rest of your very short life. Drawing a clear distinction between an actual threat to person and using deadly force to protect property. I remember one other story that maybe connects to this in some way, where it was one of those situations where the actions of the homeowner were lawful, legally, in the way that we've been talking about someone having presumed to acted lawfully protecting their home, but just absolutely tragic. And that was an incident in Florida that I was reading about, where a homeowner and his wife were in their bedroom asleep, and sometime in the early morning hours heard a noise. He had a firearm there at his bedside table, got the firearm. It was still pitch black outside. Went out of the bedroom to investigate the noise, and saw the silhouette of a person standing in the kitchen of their home. Knowing there was no one else supposed to be in the house, presuming it was an intruder who had broken in to harm them or what have you, raised the firearm and shot and killed his son that lived out of town, that had come in for a surprise visit, but came in the house not wanting to wake his parents so he could surprise them in the morning. Talk about, and I guess part of the point is, the homeowner was not prosecuted. The law protected mm-hmm. him under those facts, but good God, you know, had anything different have been done other than simply shooting the person, no questions asked, that he shot in the kitchen, a truly innocent life may have been saved, and this couple would have been spared a lifetime of grief.
Steve, we had another comment that was similar to the one I read to Don, and that simply says, when deadly force is justified, you stand your ground and implement said force. So that comment, in combination with the idea of, if an intruder physically breaks in through any barrier to access your home, you should use deadly force to meet that. Tactically, what's your response to that?
Well, one of the things I try to, look at, as I try to look at it from the perspective of the person that makes those comments, who read that article, and try to get some idea as to what they're responding to. Are they responding to this particular case with Espinoza, the fact that he did come through the door, and that Dorsey was located, probably only a few feet from him? Or was he responding, or is he talking about an intruder in general? Should you just stand your ground and defend yourself? And I would think that the circumstances play a big part of it. For instance, if I was walking up to that door because someone was knocking on it, and then the door burst open. Would I probably stand my ground? I'd probably stand my ground right there. The reason for that being that at only a few feet, you know, I believe that was, it just escaped me. But there, the Tooler drill. The Tooler drill, basically, it's been kind of misinterpreted over the years. But the essence of it was is that, you know, a healthy young male can cover about 21 feet in 1.5 seconds. And so basically, almost anyone who is, you know, 10 or 15 feet away from me can be on top of me quicker than perhaps I can draw a pistol or do much of anything. So I understand that. And I'm going to say there are circumstances where you have no other option but to deal with threat right then because, you know, everything is present. The person has apparently the ability. They have the opportunity, and based upon their actions, they're manifesting that intent. I don't have an issue with that. But the question might be to me is, well, were you actually in that position, or did you put yourself in that position and refuse to budge? And the thing about, you know, staying in that position and being that close to the door, standing my ground, whatever, that gives me absolutely no time or no meaningful time to respond to what I may see at any given moment. When all of a sudden the door comes open, the person presents itself, I then have to read all this information. What am I seeing? Can I process what I'm seeing? And can I respond to that effectively? And to that end, you know, I'm very much probably an advocate, Sean, it depends. But if the opportunity presents itself at any time to, and I'll use the word, make a tactical withdrawal to a stronger position from which I can come ensconced as opposed to just standing my ground and making that a choice, I'm going to do the former.
And I think what you say there makes a real strong point. And if we put ourselves in the mental space of the folks who sent these comments in, to be clear, we're not suggesting that if you are face to face with an intruder who has just broken into your house, that you should run away from him and hide in some other part of your house. At that point, it's game on. And to use the legal standard, that threat is reasonable and imminent, that you could be harmed and or killed. But what you're talking about is, you know, your maybe either or comment is that if you have the time, right, if you feel that he's not broken into the house yet, but that it might happen very shortly, and then you make that tactical withdrawal to a place that is more tactically defensible, like one of these hard corners, you know, that's a completely different scenario.
I absolutely agree. And I think in regards to the Espinoza event, that took place, over a greater period than 10 minutes?
About
13 minutes. And so I'm going to say the opportunity, it appears to have, you know, made your stay. Hey, you stay away. We've called the police. If you come in here, we will very well shoot you. And then move back into a more defensible position. I think that would have been a very good option, and it might have even changed the outcome of this particular case. And one of the things I also kind of take, you know, I'm very much aware of, especially from being married, is the fact that if I am forced to shoot someone in my own home, that's going to change the rest of my life in regards to how I live in this particular home with my wife.
Yeah.
And so anything I could kind of do to, you know, avoid that for multiple reasons, you know, including the whole aspect of is it the right thing to do? Kind of going back to something that I said earlier is I actually captured a burglar at gunpoint in my apartment in 1980. He made entry using a screwdriver. I didn't even hear it. My wife heard the door open and woke me up. I was untrained, I was very much of the same mindset, I think, maybe as some of these readers, and I'm still that way. I just want to do it a little bit smarter this time. Is I'm going to go out there and I'm going to put myself between the threat and my wife. And I went out there and I encountered that person at the threshold. And by the time I was actually in a position where I could have made the shot, he had surrendered. As I stepped out of my bedroom, like I said, small one bedroom apartment, the person stepped in front of it's a completely dark room. I didn't have a flashlight. He stepped in front of a mirror. He was momentarily backlit. I aimed my gun in his direction and I told him to hit the floor. I yelled that with about every fiber of my body, which he immediately did. I went over there, turned the light on, and at that point, I was absolutely justified, especially at that time in Oklahoma, in shooting him and killing him. Didn't have to do it, didn't want to do it, and as a result, I didn't do it, and held him, and the police came. And so being in that position where you can take someone's life lawfully and not be prosecuted for it, but you know in your heart it's not the right thing to do, that's a tough thing to do.
Hey guys, I wanted to ask you, since we've been talking about marriage, I wanted to ask you that if I express an opinion and my wife is not there to hear it, am I still wrong?
The answer is yes, Don.
That's,
you know, and it's funny, and since you mentioned that, and since Steve put that, that's why in the article I put that little detail in the top there, where Mrs. Dorsey screams, "Why did you do that?" And you can hear on the audio tape of it, she's just horrified, and the fact that she screams that and says that indicates to me, and I may be misinterpreting it, but she didn't think it was absolutely necessary, especially given that context, Steve, that you talked about over this 13 minutes and this, what I think clearly looked like a misunderstanding. She had a difference of opinion about how it went down. And Steve, like you, you got to move now. I'm not going to be able to sit with my wife. I mean, she's looking at the door all the time, thinking about the time the guy came in and watched me, you know, kill somebody at a front door. That's a pile of shit I don't need for the rest of my life, frankly. And you know, that's when we talk about time and distance. You talked about that in terms of tactics, right, Steve? You get time and distance, then you're in a tactically better position. Legally, Don, and you've mentioned this in your quote in the article, that more time and more distance allows you to better understand the situation, better assess the threat, and be absolutely sure that when and if you are forced to fire in self-defense, you've done it justifiably.
That's exactly right. It helps your case. It not only may save your life, or save the life of the so-called intruder, but it also helps your case if you do wind up having to justify the conduct that you engaged in, whether it's to through your lawyer to the prosecutor, or ultimately to the jury, that you in all ways acted reasonably, even perhaps even more so than the law technically required, and that you didn't react out of an irrational or unreasonable fear. You weren't acting solely out of anger, and you weren't acting to take someone's life when you figured you might be able to legally justify it, but really didn't have to do it. And all of that stuff comes into the emotional aspect of how the prosecutor and how ultimately a jury would look at this. Frankly, if you get prosecuted, if the prosecutor files those charges or the grand jury returns that indictment, you are in pretty much a life and death battle of your own all over again, because if you're charged with murder and you get convicted of murder, you're going to spend most, if not the rest of your life in prison. So anything that you can do to help yourself along the way by being more reasonable, more reflective, is certainly going to help you when you face those authorities down the road if you do.
Yeah, on that note, I want to read one last quote that will respond to. This guy says, "I'm sick and tired of losing our rights because it doesn't look good and we have to keep retreating." And this "it doesn't look good" part is what I want to respond to. I get it, right? And I think one thing that we really have to underscore through this whole conversation is we talk about a lot of very specific cases that are contingent upon the facts of that particular case. And like we said in the article, we have the benefit of looking at it with 20/20 hindsight. So in any circumstance, when someone finds themselves immediately in what they reasonably perceive as a life or death circumstance, they have to make the choice that they think is right to protect themselves, to protect their families, right? But in almost every case we've looked at, there are decisions before that life or death pull the trigger decision that the defender makes that puts them left or right of the spectrum of, are they acting out of anger? Are they acting reasonably and out of fear? And there is going to be scrutiny of those actions after a homicide. Justified or not, it's going to be scrutinized. And in that scrutiny, it becomes very important how it looks to the investigator. It becomes very important how it looks to the prosecutor. And if it gets to that point, it becomes very important how your actions look to the jury. Your freedom depends on it. So if it's right here, right now, and you're facing the bad guy, he's right there, and you're justified, you feel, and you believe imminent force is going to come your way, then you make that decision. But when you have the luxury of time and distance, those choices you make will reflect your reasonableness and give you that stronger foundation for making your claim of justifiable self-defense. That's all I have to say about that. Steve, this was, Don, unless you have another comment, I want to give Steve the final word on this, I come from this from a place of love. I believe in the right to self-defense. I'm also a zealous advocate of criminal defense, or I'm always for the underdog, and I fight for people's rights, and we're looking for lessons here. We're not softy snowflakes, and we want people to keep themselves and their families safe. But and from that perspective, though, I know it from the soft-handed writer, legal analyst point of view. I've not been in a life or death circumstance with a firearm. I'm not trained even a small fraction of what you are. So your input and your experience is highly valued. So from that perspective, what do you want? What lesson would you like concealed carriers to take from this conversation?
Well, first of all, I think the ultimate objective is going to be is that we protect ourselves, we protect our family, and we don't put ourselves in a situation where we might find ourselves, charged with a crime, whether we believe it's, justified or not, or ultimately proven to be, justifiable, which comes at, great, great personal expense. One of the things that I have tried to do over the years in some of my articles is really drive home the importance of avoiding any kind of incident in which you may be forced to use deadly force or threaten deadly force. The reason for that is that even under the best of circumstances, it's still going to be a lot of drama that's going to come into our lives. By the same token, if such a situation does, you know, emerge, then I want to win that fight. I have an obligation, not only to myself, but to my loved ones, my family, my children, my grandchildren, to protect myself as well as protect them. And I'm going to do, and I intend to do, everything within reason, to every fiber of within my body, of making sure that I don't ever let myself or them down. And sometimes we absolutely just have to go loud, which means we are going to have to fight. If we're going to have to fight and we're forced into that situation, I'd very much prefer to do it on my own terms. And in some instances, that means that I'm actually going to have to override some of my own emotions, whether it's anger or anything else, or just finally, like this guy said, I'm tired of this crap. I don't want to do it again. I'm tired of them stealing their rights. You know, I mean, I think everybody kind of feels that way. But at the end of the day, I don't want to get involved in some situation and then regret that I'd gone ahead and acted upon, you know, emotion rather than reason. I believe one gentleman said that threats should always be met, you know, at the foyer or right at the threshold, because most homes have doorways. That's not, or you know, I'm not sorry, but like hallways or some other means. The home I'm in right now does not. All the apartments, for the most part, in which I served papers over all those years, did not. People have a tendency to view things from their perspective based upon their experiences and perhaps, you know, the way their house is laid out, or perhaps the amount of crime that takes place in their neighborhood. When we write these articles, we understand that we're writing these for a broad audience, and they're going to, you know, have different life experiences. They're going to be in different crime areas, the way their homes are laid out, etc. It's all different. So I think the readers really need to kind of, you know, look at these articles and what we put out and pick and choose what is relevant to them. And if there's, you know, stuff that we say that's not relevant or they disagree, I think they're, you know, free to have that particular opinion. But one of the things that I really want to just make that point is we really want to avoid getting into a incident of any kind, lethal force especially. But if we're forced to, we want to win that fight, and then we want to win that in such a manner that CCW Safe then can win the, you know, the probably the potential legal battle in which we're going to be involved.
Don, did you have anything you wanted to add?
No, I don't. I think that sums it up, you know, and I let me just agree specifically with Steve that we try to do what we're doing to give people things to think about. We don't suggest that one size fits all, but as you think about things, maybe some new things to think about, you will find that when it comes to responsible gun ownership and respect for the law, that you will find what fits you. And should you ever be faced in a true life or death situation, that your judgment will be better as a result of that process.
And in that vein, I want to sincerely thank the readers who sent in these comments, and we respect their comments, we respect their concerns, and especially I'm appreciative that it forced us to take a deeper, more specific look into these issues. And I think that's what this effort's all about, is with the help of our members and our readers, we look at different circumstances, we envision what would we do in that circumstance. And the more time that we spend doing that, I think the more prepared we'll be. God forbid that should ever happen to us. Thank you. That's the podcast. Thanks for listening. Thank you again for your thoughtful comments. And everyone, be smart, be safe. Take care.